Upon my cargo, your knowledge does not confer for funding. It is my great pleasure to introduce our opening plenary speaker, Professor Nicholas Himmelman from the University of Princeton. Professor Himmelman is a renowned Austronesianist and a veteran field worker with diverse research interests ranging from morphosyntactic theory, grammaticalization, discourse analysis, prosody and grammar, and of course, documentation theory. He's a co-editor of this book, Essentials of Language Documentation, which is an invaluable source of useful and practical information for anyone who is concerned with undocumented or underdocumented languages. He has done field work in the Philippines, Sulawesi, and East Timor, and recently Indonesia and Papua. And he is now involved in a documentation project on Waimara, an isolating Austronesian language of East Timor. He's also currently president of the German Society for Endangered Languages. Professor Himmelman's groundbreaking article, Documentary and Descriptive Linguistics, published in 1998, marked the beginning of the new era of language documentation. In it, he argued for the necessity of separating documentation from description of a language, and he proposed that documentation should be regarded as an independent activity called documentary linguistics. The defining characteristic of this new approach to language documentation is the emphasis on primary data, especially its interdisciplinary value and its usefulness to the speech community. As we all know, his seminal article ignited a remarkably successful movement among linguists to develop the methodologies of documentary linguistics and was followed by a surge of major internationally funded language documentation programs. Today, he will be speaking about three different kinds of linguistic data and their respective importance in linguistic research. Please welcome Professor Nicholas Himmelman.
Thanks a lot, Yuko, for this very friendly and flattering introduction, and thanks very much indeed to Nick Tinberg and Ken Ray for inviting me to come here. It's a great honor, and I'm very flattered, and it has already been a very exciting event, although it's just starting, and I'm sure it's going to be staying like that for the next 3 days. There's a quite large time slot given for this plenary talk, something like 75 minutes, including discussion. Don't expect me to go on for so long. I'm going to aim for about 45 to 50 minutes, and I hope then we will have a lively discussion. And now, okay, the video is on as well, and I can actually start. There is a handout, but you don't actually need it. Everything I have to say is actually on PowerPoint slides. It's more for your references. Okay, I start with some common misunderstandings or misconceptions about documentary linguistics, such as documentary linguistics is all about technology and digital archiving, or documentary linguistics is just concerned with, often said, mindlessly heaping up data without any concern for analysis or structure, or documentary linguistics is actually opposed to analysis. Obviously all not true, but I will try to make this clearer in this talk, taking into account some of the possible reasons for these misunderstandings, for which I see mostly two, or primarily two. The one is that the inter and transdisciplinary nature of documentary linguistics makes it necessary to modify certain central tenets of linguistics when one works on language documentation. And the second one is the fairly complex nature of the relation between language documentations and what I call analytical formats, such as descriptive grammars. So the structure of my talk today is going to be, in the first part, I will speak about linguistic data types, and in this way try to place documentary linguistics within the overall discipline of linguistics to find a systematic place for documentary linguistics in the discipline. And in the second part, I will more specifically address this issue of descriptive formats, descriptive analysis, and language documentation. So it's, as you know, it's going to be a fairly theoretical and fairly linguistic talk, and I'm aware of the fact that some of you are not really interested in these matters, but that's what the organizers asked me to do, and so I'm trying to be compliant, but I also hope it's not going to be too boring for you. Okay, let's start with basic linguistic data types, and the distinction I'm proposing is according to processes stages, raw, primary, and structural. And I start with something which actually has been well established in the 19th century, which is a well-established philological practice from the 19th century, where people have been dealing with historical data in the way of inscriptions or original manuscripts. So when they work on that, the first level they are dealing with is the original inscription or the original manuscript, and that's what I'm going to call raw data. But these raw data are often incomplete and need interpretation in order to be really useful. So in a second step, there used to be, and there still is for those people who do philology, something called philological criticism, which means editing manuscripts, which means filling in holes in inscriptions. Yeah, in an inscription often there's a letter missing or there's even a full word missing, and so you have to make some guesses, some reasoned guesses, as to what the original inscription or the original manuscript was intended to be, or in the case of manuscripts of the Bible or other important documents, there are normally various manuscripts around, and you have to collate them and produce one basic form which you think is the original text. So what results from that is what is called a critical edition, which kind of reflects the raw data but also has added information in the sense that it's more complete and that there is an idea of what the inscription or what the manuscript actually was. And these primary data then, in a second step, serve as the basis for disciplinary historical kind of generalizations or interpretations. So what you get from looking at such critical editions when you work on language history is data on language and culture history, and I give you a German example. So from looking at these various manuscripts from medieval German, you can then see that Old High German now become Middle High German and things like that. That's what I call structural data, yeah, which are based on these, they're not usually based directly on any inscriptions, they are based on what I call primary data. And the suggestion now is that basically the same things happen with the more common types of linguistic data we are dealing with in linguistics and in language documentation. And here I make a distinction between two basic types of data. One is data based on observable linguistic behavior. For example, people discussing something, and you can make a record of that. And data based on metalinguistic knowledge. You basically can think of that as data from elicitation. Yeah? You ask people something about their language, and they give you some kind of rating or information about that. So, for example, an acceptability rating to a sentence, and people say, this is okay, it's not okay. That's what I call data from metalinguistic knowledge. And the raw data is, on the one hand, recordings, on the other hand, tokens of acceptability ratings or paradigms you elicit and other things. I will give you more examples later on. And then in the second step, quite like, it's not called philological criticism, but in the second step, in order to actually make these data useful for linguistics and other disciplines, you have to work on them for the data of based on linguistic observable linguistic behavior. You have to make transcription and some other steps I will come back to, and what results from that is a transcript with translation, and that's from the level of observable linguistic behavior, what I call primary data. And in the area of metalinguistic knowledge, you get actually acceptability ratings for a certain sentence over a certain population. And then in the next step, you have the fairly well-established methods, both of descriptive linguistics, but also frequency statistics and others, and then you get what I call structural data. And that's a pretty heterogeneous set of things like statements of distribution, preferred readings, frequency data, tree banks, dictionary entries, implicational data, implicational universals, and other things. If this was a bit too fast, I go through this three times, so don't worry. we come back to this again. If I put the whole two things now together, we have on the right hand side, we have the historical data, and then we have these other types of data linguists are normally dealing with. And for me, the main difference between these is that with the synchronic data, you basically have the possibility for direct input by native speakers, while what I call historical data means that you only have an indirect input by native speakers. You can't really talk with them about the data, and that changes the methodology. So historical data is, you don't have to think about medieval and ancient times. Historical data is also legacy data from just 30 years ago, if there's no speaker left anymore. But historical data in a certain way also can build field notes, which needs a lot of interpretation in order to be used, but still you can't access the writer anymore and the speakers usually as well. So what I'm going to do now in the next step is to discuss a little bit more about the data based on observable behavior and actually illustrate us the three steps or the three stages with one example. There are different types of data based on observable linguistic behavior. The recording I already mentioned. But there's also something which you could call observational field notes. So you're sitting somewhere and you can make a note saying speaker X just now used the demonstrative for while way for something just next to her. Yeah, she pointed to a knife next to her and used the distal demonstrative, and you observed that you couldn't record it because you were just sitting there, but it's a valid observation. You put that in your field notes, and as a written, already somewhat analyzed thing, it's already directly primary data, though. There's no raw data where you can actually check this with, unlike the recordings. And there's a third type of primary data, which is fairly well known and used in corpus linguistics. And that's written documents in standard orthography, where a certain step of preparing the data is no longer necessary. You already have your segmentation in various levels, etc. So I would say written documents in a standard orthography which don't need further editing are already directly primary data. So in order to illustrate this with a concrete example, I'm going to show you one example from this language Waimaa, spoken in East Timor, which I've been working on for a couple of years now, within the framework of a documentation project together with the colleagues listed up there. So on the level of raw data, we just have the speaker, in this case, Armando Amanyo, telling us a nice story about the seven birds.
Aproveita que dança a mim, que deve ter bem em mim.
Yeah, so that's the raw data. The primary data, as I said, is the transcription and translation of these raw data, which you have to do with the help of a native speaker. So what he actually says is, they took advantage of the people's dance. The people, they had this tebe tebe. Tebe tebe is the type of dance you have in East Timor. I just play you the example once again.
Aproveita que dançando. Que tebe tebe ni.
So, what has to happen in order to derive the primary data from the raw data? Among other things, the following three very important steps or things you have to do. One is segmentation. Yeah? The recording is one big flow, and in order to have that put into writing, you have to segment it in various ways. So you have to identify sound segments, words, and intonation units. You obviously also need some kind of indication of the meaning of the lexical content items and the overall construction. So you want, on the one hand, an indication of what the whole sentence or the whole intonation unit means, and on the other hand, you want to have an idea of what every word in the unit means. And I actually say content items because you normally can't get meanings for small functional words, right? So if you work with a native speaker, they can tell you what aproveita means, but they can't tell you what nini means. Yeah, I come back to the nini thing again. And very importantly, you can only do this with direct native speaker input. You can't do it all by yourself. If I just tried this a couple of weeks ago where someone sent me a very nice video recording eliciting body parts, but it was enormously difficult both on the sound level as well as on the meaning level to find out what was going on, because they were pointing and saying hand, but he was pointing here, but it wasn't clear whether it was the whole arm or only the hand, etc. So you can't really do anything without a native speaker working on this type of data. So structural data then are generalizations or generalizing interpretations of primary data. For example, Nini marks possession with third person possessors. You remember this sentence had this Nini at the end in both cases. Or you can observe that Nini always follows the possessum, but the possessor may precede or follow the possessum. Possessum is the thing, the item possessed, and the possessor is the person who owns it. So you can say in Waimaa, ne wau nini, or you can say wau ne nini, both meaning grew up in sort of their pigs. Yeah, so the nini is fixed, but the pronoun indicating the possessor can be either before or after thing possessed. You can also make observations such as postponed possessors are less common than preposed ones, or basic word order in Waimaa is subject, verb, object, or even more generally, typological statements such as isolating languages tend to have serial verb construction. Now that's all illustrating the type of data I call structural data. It's quite clear that this is a very heterogeneous group, but it's from the view of processing, it forms a group. Yeah? That's the only thing I'm saying. And you are welcome, other people are welcome to further subclassify structural data. But from this processing point of view, I think there's good reason to put them all in one group. So, summarizing this very basic distinction I have been proposing, we have these three levels: raw data, primary data, and structural data. And there's a more philosophical way of arguing for this distinction. I just presented it to you and showed it to you, and I'm hoping on intuitive plausibility. But if you were going to press me for a more systematic argument, I would have to come up with some more philosophy and epistemology. And I've just indicated this on this slide. So the major difference between primary data and raw data on the one hand and structural data on the other hand is what I call the difference between particular and general. General meaning without historical identity. So if the claim that possessors can proceed or follow the possessum in Waimaa in the Waimaa spoken at the late 20th century in the village I have been working in, is true. It is true regardless of who's saying that and regardless at what time it has been said. Yeah, it's a fact, as linguists like to say that. And it's completely independent of who has been saying it and when it has been said. This is not true of raw data and primary data. Yeah, primary data, especially the actual performance of some linguistic event, is absolutely particular. It's non-replicable. It happens one time, one speaker, in one situation, and given the time and space changes all the time, you can't replicate exactly the same event. You can have the speaker tell the story twice, but it's not the absolute same event. Yeah, so it's absolutely unique. And primary data is also in some sense particular because it actually happened, it actually matters who is doing the transcription, segmentation, derivation, or in historical terms, the philological criticism. Yeah, and it's not by chance that, for example, edited manuscripts, they have the name of the editor on it, because it's one person or a team of people who did it. And if someone else had done it, it probably would have come out a little bit different. I mean, one would hope that the main things come out the same, but there will always be a little bit of difference. So I'm quite sure if other people had worked on the Waimaa corpus we have been collected, and they had the same training and basic same ideas about linguistics than myself and my colleagues, still the transcriptions and segmentations would vary in small details. It wouldn't be absolutely the same. Yeah, because everyone has certain preferences and there are some things which are not fully determined in the relation between raw and primary data. So you can actually have work a number of teams on the same set of raw data and you will get different types of primary data. Hopefully they wouldn't vary too much in too large details, but there will be differences, I'm quite sure. So primary data is particular because it involves specific people, specific native speakers, specific researchers, and they are non-unique because if different speakers, different researchers would work on them, they would come up with a different set of primary data. So much for philosophy. I don't intend to go into detail regarding data based on meta-linguistic knowledge. I just wanted to show to you what I basically mean by that. I already mentioned acceptability rating, but this type of data would also include things you would do in psycholinguistics. You build up some kind of experiment and have some reaction time measuring or something like that. That's also what I would call data based on meta-linguistic knowledge, tapping somehow the knowledge speakers have about their languages. Yeah, and it also includes elicitation of words, paradigms, taxonomies, and things like that. And strictly speaking, it would also include the type of data most favored by linguists in the 70s and 80s, namely introspection. Yeah, so the raw datum in this case would be the introspection, and what you actually derive from that is an invented example. And we all know that this type of data has many, many problems, and people are luckily kind of getting away from that. What is a particularity of this data based on metalinguistic knowledge is that statistics, and statistics especially, I think, are very important in deriving good primary data from such raw data as a time measurement in a psycholinguistics experiment. For those of you who are familiar with the 70s and 80s and 60s discussion about data in linguistics, there was a big fuss made about the distinction between acceptability and grammaticality. And I'm happy to say that it's actually gone now. I mean, everyone now, almost everyone now accepts that while there may be a reason or a good reason to make such a distinction on a theoretical level, actually, in terms of actual research practice, it's not feasible. And I'm quoting here from Carsten Schitze, who has written about this very nicely within a generative framework. And he concludes in the bolded section, all that a linguistically naive subject can do is judge its acceptability. Yeah, so all you can do is actually get acceptability ratings, and what you interpret then as mere acceptability or showing something about grammaticality is a matter of interpretation. The important point for documentary linguistics and also for fieldwork is that elicitation and all types of data collection which have to do with tapping linguistic knowledge actually involve quite a lot of work in thinking about sampling and trying to get good data tokens and doing statistic analysis. It's not an easy thing to do elicitation. Yeah, that's, I think, what follows from this line of research. And I should emphasize that many things that I'm saying here, especially in this part, it's not all my own thinking and claims, but it's, I think now we're fairly well established also in the more formal types of linguistics, and on in the list of references you have, you get quite a few recent works from 2004 onwards about data and linguistics, where basically these things are being said. So, coming towards the end of this section, I'm now in a position to give you a somewhat new and broadened definition of documentary linguistics. What I think is documentary linguistics is about, in terms of a disciplinary exercise or subfield, it's basically concerned with the relation between raw data and primary data. Yeah, and both on both types, both data based on observable linguistic behavior and data based on meta-linguistic knowledge. And what we know as descriptive linguistics is basically a concern with the relation between primary data and structural data. And I think this is fairly, is much better established. And what documentary linguistics in a certain way is about is actually focusing the attention on the steps which are involved in deriving primary data from raw data. And that's something which linguistics, I would claim, has almost totally ignored for most of its history. It was always it has always been assumed that whatever someone writes, publishes as a text collection or something, that's it, and we start from there. And there's no reason and no need to actually look further beyond how did this text collection, how did this transcription come about. Yeah, and it's kind of surprising that within structural or descriptive linguistics especially, no one has ever written about a theory of transcription or something. Yeah? The really core article, the classic article on transcription is by Eleanor Oakes, coming from psycholinguistics, coming from child language research. It's also on your handout, I think, and I highly recommend that. I think that's something where people working, documenting linguists can learn quite a lot from. But here the main point is, within core linguistics, within fieldworking linguistics, transcription and various other matters related in the relating to the relationship between raw data and primary data hasn't been much concern. And the basic idea of documentary linguistics is to say that's something you have to focus on as well if you want to be in a serious empirical science. So, major topics in documentary linguistics resulting from this fairly broad definition is much broader than many people probably would have thought, and note importantly that it is not concerned primarily or exclusively with language documentation. Language documentation is one exercise, as it were, you can do within documentary linguistics, but documentary linguistics is not confined to language documentation. So what the major topics are, as I've already hinted at, there are methods and standards for generating and capturing raw data. There are methods, or it should be concerned with methods and standards for deriving primary data from raw data and for the representation. interpretation of primary data, yeah, exactly this thing about transcription, about segmentation, about thinking how's, what's the best way of representing recordings, but also how to edit and represent field notes, how to evaluate field notes, etc., things like that. And there's also, of course, the methods and standards for making raw and primary data accessible, which would include archiving. And this is the point where actually technology comes in. I mean, it should be clear to everyone, and I don't think I have to emphasize this very much in this group. I mean, it's not a fad of some computer nerds that one should be concerned about technology in this context. It just makes sense for modern science to make use of the technology that's available. It's not something you just want to be fashionable or something. I mean, there are good ways now of archiving things digitally, and it would be stupid for linguistics not to do it. And just to say the obvious, this whole working on these different levels is obviously not a theory-free enterprise. I mean, what you consider raw data and how you deal with raw data is influenced by your theories, and how you transcribe and represent primary data is influenced by your theories. So there's always this interrelationship between what we, on the one hand, and what linguists are really mostly interested in, that's on the right-hand side, theories and models, yeah? So linguistics and I myself, we are interested in theory of language change and phrase structure, hierarchies and scales, etc., etc. And this feeds into the way we are actually collecting and representing data. And of course, the data should in some way also reflect or influence our theories. And there's no doubt about the fact that, of course, in some way, linguists interested in theories and models, the main thing they are interested in are structural data, and I don't have any problem with that. I mean, this is the basis for theorizing. But good theorizing presupposes that you're actually aware that this the structural data is not simple, just given. Yeah? I mean, this is the basic last 30 years in linguistics has been to say structural data, they were called facts, yeah, and they were simple. You don't have to think about them, they're just given. Yeah, there's no need for further reflection on how you get to these structural generalizations. And in a certain way, that's what documentary linguistics is about. Okay, this concludes the first part of my presentation, and I now come to the second part, which is more specifically concerned with language documentation and the relation to descriptive analysis. I think most of you here will be familiar with what a language documentation is supposed to be. I just included this slide as a reminder. So a language documentation consists of primary data with linked raw data as much as those are available. They are annotated in various ways in something which you could call an apparatus, which would include the transcriptions and translations, but also so-called metadata on when recorded, etc., etc. So, what's the relation between language documentation and descriptive enterprises such as grammars, dictionaries, and the like? There is an absolute analytical minimum that you can do within a language documentation, I would claim. And that's the level of analysis needed to make the data compiled in a documentation accessible in a useful way. That is, avoiding all the dilemmas commonly associated with unannotated raw data. And this is one of the tricky points I always stumble over when trying to explain this concept. Of course, on some level, it is true that all types of data are useful and can be used at some time in some way. So the Romans who made inscriptions didn't have the intention to give the data to reconstruct Romance language history, right? And that was not a compilation of data in order to do this. And this causes lots of problems in the sense that these inscriptions, they provide data, but they need an enormous amount of speculation and interpretation in order to be useful. Having this experience, one should of course try to make data collections one starts now in such a way that one avoids exactly the dilemmas which one can study when one looks at the way people have been dealing with historical manuscripts and inscriptions. Yeah, but still, of course, in some way, I agree with Tony Whitmerby, who says it's useful to have a recording and have a speaker just give you a rough translation. At some point, someone will be able to make something out of that. Yeah, but when you actually focus on compiling a good collection of data for use in various purposes, you want to make them accessible in a good way, and that means that you have to analyze them at least to the level that you get the transcription, a word-by-word meaning, and a translation. And that's what I would call the accessibility function of analysis. And most people, I think, involved in the language documentations would agree to that. There's also, I think, reasonable widespread agreement about the fact that ideally, talking about the ideal world, a comprehensive language documentation would include a number of fully elaborated analyses such as descriptive grammars, dictionaries, ethnographies, or what have you. Yeah, I don't put that into question. I think if there were no limits of time and money, then one should do that. And it would be helpful to do that for the simple reason that whatever you do in terms of analysis will be helpful in ensuring the comprehensiveness of the documentation. Yeah? So if the goal of language documentations is to have a comprehensive record of the language at a given time, there is a big practical and also theoretical problem of determining how do you know when a language documentation is complete. Yeah, the answer is it's never complete, but still you would have to want some measure of saying it has progressed at least. It's not you have added useful stuff, and in order to have such measures, it is no doubt about the fact I think that analysis help you in detecting holes. That's something which Richard Rhodes and others have been calling the accounting function of analysis, and I think there is reasonably widespread agreement, at least I would agree to that, that this is something useful and something one cannot deny. The problem, the problems which come in are two, I would think. There is, on the one hand, the problem of how to deal with conflicts of interests that may arise between the different tasks and goals that a language documentation ideally demands. Yeah, and I will come explain that in a minute. And the other issue is ideas for new analytical formats or modifications of existing formats that take full advantage of the potential of digital language documentations. I will go through these two points now, starting with the first one, conflicts of interests. I just said ideally, language documentation would contain any number of analytical formats. But of course, in the real world, all projects, including in particular documentation projects, are very heavily constrained with regard to money and time. You can't do everything. Projects normally run 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. They have one staff, three staff, five staff, but that's it. And there's only so much you can do. And the question then always arises, what are you going to do? I mean, what are the possibilities, what are the demands, and how do you decide between the different options that arise? And there are many possibilities from my point of view. Descriptive grammar is one, but there are also the possibility of writing an orthography or being a bit smaller in your analysis and writing syntax papers or one syntax paper or running a psycholinguistic experiment or working on educational materials. Yeah? And in as much as all these possibilities contribute to the accounting function of analysis, there does not appear to be an a priori reason to declare one analytical project more important than another. And that's the price you have to pay for interdisciplinarity, and that's where I basically get into trouble with my colleagues in typology. Yeah? For them it's clear that descriptive grammar is the thing to do. And I say, yes, I also like writing grammars. Oh, no, not like reading grammars. I haven't managed to write one yet, but I actually would love to write one. Yes, I'm really interested in grammars, but I mean, I can't, from a point of view of someone trying to do theory here, I can't find a theoretical reason which kind of would force me to say, yes, you have to do descriptive grammars, because I think all analytical formats in some way have the potential to show your holes in the documentation, and from that point of view they are equally valid in terms of the accountability function. Yeah, that's the crux of the matter. And actually, in order to be one should actually be also aware that linguistics itself would be fractioned if you make a choice, if you say to hardcore linguists, what is the important documentary, the important analytical format you want to have in a language documentation, then it would split immediately in two. And then the typologists want the grammar, and the historical linguists want dictionaries. Right? So it's not even unanimous within the core group what the good analytical format is. And you're talking about descriptive grammars, for example, there's some agreement about what a good descriptive grammar is, but there's also not a clear guideline of how you would do the really good descriptive grammar for a language documentation. So those are all reasons why I think that, at least in terms of a theoretical approach in trying to argue deductively for one or the other format, there is no real conclusion, and that's why I have been arguing for quite some time for something that I would call a pragmatic resolution. Yeah, and that's simply to say, do what is pragmatically feasible in terms of the wishes and needs of the speech community and in terms of your own specific needs and interests. Yeah, and it seems to me fairly clear, of course, if you do a language documentation within a linguistics program at the University of Hawaii, you want to include something which is more hardcore linguistics. You want to do some syntax, or you want to do some psycholinguistics or something. But that's something which comes in from the pragmatics of the project, because you are doing some degree, you want to do a master's or a PhD, and then, of course, you want to include in the documentary works something which shows that you are capable of linguistic analysis. But it's not something which I would think you could do, which you could put up as the requirement for all types of language documentation projects. There are different needs and different interests, and whoever carries out documentation projects has to take into account what they themselves need and what the speech community they are working with have in terms of wishes and needs. So there are a few other issues related to the one I have been just now trying to show to you. That's the one, the conflict more generally between the time demanded in carrying out and formulating analysis and the possibility to invest more time to increase the amount of annotated raw data. That's a very tricky issue. The core of this issue is about how good is the accounting function of certain descriptive formats. And the other issue which always comes up is the issue between corpus compilation and elicitation, which is also much misunderstood. But I don't want to go into this. If you are interested, you can go to this in the discussion time. I just want to conclude this subsection with a more personal note on my rhetorical reasons for downplaying the importance of descriptive grammars within this whole free framework, which has made me not enemies, but difficulties with friends, because I'm actually in the grammar reading community. So the one rhetorical reason very simply was and still is to highlight the need for and the specific character of language documentations. And the other reason, which in some ways is perhaps more important, especially for the younger people here in the audience, who probably can't be aware of the fact that at the time when linguistics finally took notice of the challenges implied by a large-scale language endangerment, the first reaction basically was, especially in the linguistics establishment, and I have a quote here from Robbins and Muhlenbeck, who at the time were the presidents and secretary of the Comité International Permanent de Linguistique, de Linguistes, which is the international organization of linguists. So when they finally took notice of language endangerment as a serious issue for the discipline, the first reaction was, oh, let's go out and write grammars. Yeah? And that was the main focus of this reaction. And there were quite a few people who tried to make it clear that this can't be the main reaction, but there has to be more. There has to be more concern for speech communities and various other things. So that's the main rhetorical reason why I personally have been downplaying the importance of grammars. Good. Let's very briefly, and I don't really have to say much about this, come to the experimental formats. There is the question of whether the modern typologically informed reference grammars, the types of grammars that have been produced in the last 20 years or so, is the best we can do in terms of basic grammatical description. Yeah, that's the question. I mean, that's what should happen in all good science, that every once in a while we think about, is this the best way we should do? And language documentation is one context where this question arises. And Nick Tiberger, whom I'm quoting here, has written quite nicely about something which doesn't really question descriptive grammars in its basic way. It just says there are many good ways of improving this format and making it more accountable to the raw and primary data it is sitting on. And I think that's a fully legitimate enterprise, as is the enterprise of more radically questioning the format of descriptive grammars. And argue for something like a distributed annotation across corpus of raw and primary data, as Tony Woodbury has done it. I personally am not convinced that this is really going to work yet, but I think it's fully legitimate and one should actually think about these issues and really question whether certain habits one has established in writing about grammar but also in doing dictionaries and other analytical formats, one should question every once in a while and think about whether one can do things better. All right, I think this is it already, coming very close. I just summarized the main points once again. So I hope that I could convince you that documentary linguistics is not at all opposed to analysis, linguistic or other, but rather complements and enhances analytical and theoretical projects in core linguistics by focusing attention on a part of the empirical foundations of the discipline which hitherto have been largely ignored. And that's the collection and processing of raw and primary data. And I should emphasize the fact that psycholinguists and social linguistics have been doing this for all the time. I mean, it has always been the issue there, and core linguists and people working in the field and doing language implementations, they can learn almost everything from them. I mean, they have developed sampling techniques, they have thought a lot. I mean, social linguists have thought a lot about recording, different ways of trying to get data, etc. And I think it's high time that this also comes into the more typologically and other types of linguistics. So language documentations, as I've tried to make clear as well, are not opposed to descriptive analysis. Actually, by definition, they involve at least a non-negligible amount of descriptive analysis, which I've been calling accessibility function. And they are in principle open for fully elaborated descriptive formats of various kinds, including grammars. And they are seen from a language documentation point of view, they have an ancillary function in there, which one could call accountability function, but it doesn't mean saying that something is ancillary that it's not really important. The format is totally open for this. But there is not one particular, and this is the point where I think I disagree with some of my colleagues, there's not one particular analytical format which is especially privileged with regard to the accounting function. And therefore, there arises a competition between different demands and interests. Yeah, and documentary linguistics actually explicitly acknowledges this potential and argues or proposes a pragmatic resolution. And these conflicts of interests, of course, are especially prone to arise in projects relating to endangered languages. Because here time is running out. Here you have the real conflict. If you're working on a language which is going to be spoken about for another 2,000 years, there's no problem in time. You can focus your project on whatever you are interested in. But the real conflict only arises when you're working on endangered languages, because there are so many different things one could do at the time, and the monies are very limited. Yeah, and as I've said, I argue for a pragmatic resolution of these conflicts. Thank you very much for coming and for your attention. Especially the level of primary data, and I have another talk on the hybrid nature of primary data. You could argue for various sub-distinctions there. But I think what, in some way, I would say is the characteristic of raw data is it's actually the starting point. It's not whether it's has been produced by non-native speakers and kind of foreign elements have been introduced, or in the audio recording you have some noise in the background or whatever. I mean, that's what you start. And the level of primary data, at least on the highest level of primary data, is an attempt from whatever your sources you have, you try to reconstruct some kind of idea about what the actual event or the actual sentence or the actual utterance has been. Yeah? And that's all where you go on from. Yeah? The idea of primary data is a a critical edition of what you get as raw data. And there's a problem with the field notes. They are in a certain way on two levels. I fully agree if you use them for editing something or for helping you to go on with recordings, they are more like raw data. But if you just take field notes where someone has basically compiled a lot of paradigms, they are primary data because you can go from there. It's a mixed thing. I fully agree with that. But I think the major point is this origin with some type of native speaker, which makes it absolutely unique. And primary data is something which you write from that, and you can get various versions. I think that's the more epistemological defining features. And for every type of data, you can think about this criterion, and then you can put it in either the one or the other bracket.
Can I just make one organizational suggestion, that when people ask questions, they identify themselves. Since this is being recorded, it probably would help. That was Andrew Garrett, and I turn the microphone over to you.
John Clifton. I had a question, also relating to the relationship between raw data and primary data, as a theoretical side and a practical side. As I'm actually doing, or working with, native speakers to do transcription, of course, one of the things that frequently comes up is people say, that was a mistake. Of course, sometimes it's simply being prescriptive. Sometimes they don't like the loan word that, in fact, people use all the time. So on other times, it really is legitimately a mistake. There is one word that everybody would agree is the right word. The person couldn't think of it at the time. They happen to use or they have a sentence fragment or whatever. Which, of course, are all very interesting from the point of view of what kinds of fragments you can get and so on. But people want to change those. So now we've got basically a metalinguistic, the two columns between the observable linguistic behavior and the metalinguistic knowledge start to come into play and start to interact with each other as you're preparing your transcript. And that's the theoretical side now in terms of what do we do? Do we try to basically come up with multiple primary transcripts, one of which reflects the actual the actual utterances, one of which now reflects what people, the metalinguistic knowledge that they bring to it, saying this is right, this needs to be changed, whatever. Secondly, the practical side of it, we'd like to save all of the primary, the raw data. But yet, we've had situations where people say, you can't possibly save that recording, and this is by the person who gave it, that there are so many mistakes on there, that would be embarrassing to make public, to let anybody else hear. There, that's just not good language. So what do you do now on the practical side of it?
Yeah, I have solutions for everything. what you are saying is, I think most of us who are actually doing these things, they are very familiar with the problems you are mentioning. And I can just tell you what I personally do without laying any claim to that that's the truth. I think the biggest problem arises when you actually can't store the raw data. Yeah? Because once, as long as you can make available the raw data, whatever you do in terms of transcriptions can always be rechecked against the raw data, and even a highly edited transcription will allow you to make good use of the raw data because you can yourself find out that there was a false start and things like that. So as long as the raw data is available, I think there are not so many concerns about what kind of drift you give to the transcription. Although, personally, my goal is always to provide something which would I would call a base transcript, where you actually include everything. And especially working with native speakers, I've tried to explain to them how important this is and how useful it can be for various purposes. So to really make a transcript which includes all laughing and false starts, etc., and then say whatever other people have for needs, you can produce different types of edited versions. Yeah? And there's something very interesting in this whole process of editing basic transcripts to become, for example, literacy material or something which is actually accepted in the speech community, because especially in those communities where you don't have literacy before, you don't have a literate language, a written language before you, what you actually get in this process is the invention of a written language. And that's in itself a very interesting process, which one actually would like to see more documented in order to get better ideas about what's actually the full range of differences between written and spoken languages. And what happens when you actually invent writing in a community which didn't have it. Yeah, but that's ideal. I mean, one has to go on in terms of feasibility. And if you don't have, if it's not possible to make the raw data available, but only this edited version, then that's what you can do. And there's always some use to some things. I mean, it's better if you can make the raw data available, but I mean, I don't think that one should argue for some documentarist fundamentalism. Only documentation with full availability of raw data is good. I mean, it's a tenet, it's a goal you want to achieve, and if it's possible, it's good, but if not, what can you do? Thanks.
Elena Benedicto, Purdue University. I was missing one variable in your nice table in the beginning, table/model, and it's a variable that you have been touching upon later on while talking about different issues. In a variable that didn't exist in the philological, in the 19th century philological model that you use, and that's the speech community. And because it didn't exist for the data, the historical data that we were using then. And but now it's an important part of when we do language documentation. And you've mentioned it in your pragmatic resolution or whatever you called it. You mentioned the wishes of the speech community, but I think that if we are theorizing about or establishing models about what constitutes what and what we do, it is important that that part of the equation is there and is mentioned, and we talk about how to deal with it or how to interact with it.
Thank you very much. I have to think about that. I fully agree with you about the importance of involvement of the speech community. There's no doubt about that. The question I have right now in trying to answer this question is that I don't see how you can fit. I mean, how you can fit it in this type of table kind of thing, because there's no one is really mentioned. I mean, there's not the researchers or anything. It's a table about data types. Yeah, it doesn't.
Well, the researchers are there.
But the researchers are not in the table. As
they
far
are
as
in the analysis. They are hidden
in the
analysis.
Yeah, but the speakers, when I was trying to spell out the table, then you always had on three slides the direct input by native speaker. I mean, it enters the table in various ways, because as I say, one important distinction between this historical and non-historical data is the direct native speaker input, so I have that. But not the speech community as something which has specific needs and concerns. And I'm not quite sure whether that's really a valid part of the table yet. I mean, as I said, I have to think about that. It's not something I have really thought through. So, thank you.
Work provider. The energy spots in Elliot's who comes to Tinif is Lars and Elliot's in the Funchatum as Oop as Kolak and Elliot's from Minston. The Chai to Suach. I honor those people of this land who have allowed me to come into their house to speak. And I'm Dr. Ronald Ignace from the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, Kamloops, British Columbia, Canada. And what prompted me to come here, I wasn't going to come up and talk, but there's a end of a sentence up there that said, what do linguists do if all the languages are gone. You know, and I've thought of that myself. What are you guys going to do once all the languages are gone? Where do you work? Do you move on to something else? But I don't think that's Dawsdeek's Khilam. I think that what needs to be, you know, we on the ground, indigenous peoples on the land, struggling to survive our languages. I was chief from 1982 for just a few months ago, for over 20 years. And one of the issues I fought, I was chair of the National Chiefs Committee on Languages for Canada, for our national organization. But even though we're organized nationally, as indigenous peoples, our numbers are too few to have effect, and not strong enough to have impact on the government. So what's led me to think, and let me say that I'm not belittling the work of linguists and others. For example, I'm glad that Boaz had sent Tate to the interior and pickled all our stories and our culture. You know, so now I've been able to go to the cupboard and pull out those pickled stories and pickled languages and open them up and try to bring life back to them. And I think that it served a purpose, but I was able to cross-reference that with living elders, which gave it the true life that it had. And indigenous languages and cultures are truly the greatest heritage of any country. And too often I see governments spending millions and millions of dollars reviving 100-year-old buildings because of its heritage value, where I think that's misspent resources. Because I think indigenous languages and cultures have a lot to offer, you know, in terms of worldviews, philosophies, and could have a significant, profound impact on understanding the universe. And I know physicists are turning to indigenous languages because the English language can't take them to places where they ought to go or need to go, and to understand the universe in greater detail. But that's another story. So what I think that you people here who are mobile and travel around the world, go to different, have great contacts. I proposed this at a UNESCO conference in France, that there ought to be established an international endangered languages fund, much like the World Wildlife Fund, with activists like them behind that fund, so that people like myself, practitioners of the language and instructors in our communities, could come together and share common practices, best practices amongst different indigenous peoples from around the world, at least on an annual basis. And not only that, but also have the ability to share our cultures with each other. I mean, looking at the rich cultural heritage here is incredible. I wish more of the people could experience that. And I think that if there's a way that we can begin becoming more proactive, I mean, I think now is the time when the stars are all lining up, when we look at what's happening in this country or in the United States, there's a great opportunity to create a campaign so that the United States may change its policy in adopting the UN Declaration on Indigenous Rights. And if the United States were to do that, Canada, like a puppy, would follow soon behind. instead of voting for it, you know, Canada, Australia, and the US are voting against that. But there has to be some type of discussion among people like yourselves. With your help, I think we could begin turning the tide of the endangered languages falling over the edge, the precipice of extinction. And I appeal to you to give serious thought about that. It's great work that you're doing, pickling our languages and our cultures. But let's make them lasting and living legacies. And I think that you'd provide a great service not only to indigenous peoples, but also to the world. And the moment, I think, to do it is now. And this group starts up as Kalal Manjob, as Nukunjatsu Pagadias Kalayan Juman. Unakami and Bosman is Kalayan Juman at Yas Hilam. I think the time, and I thank you for listening to me and giving me this opportunity to speak to all of you, but the time to do something is now, so we should all stand up and fight for what we are. We have elders back home that for nothing, they'll go and spend their time in classes teaching the language. They go to class to teach the language, but they also, you know, 80-year-old elders, they go there so they can, from the young people, learn how to read and write it. So there's, you know, it's fantastic. But we have to move beyond just merely pickling other people's languages and cultures. Thank you, Isko Sefa.
So we can take two short questions.
Just say one word of thank you for your comments, and I think like almost everyone in this room, I fully agree with you in what you say. The core problem in trying to get more activism, I would say, in terms of language endangerment and maintenance is this problem you mentioned of intangibility. Languages compare badly to pyramids. And this is a problem we have been, or I have been thinking, many people have been thinking about in trying to make the case for more support in this regard. And I think that's the point one has to think about, of how to get beyond this intangibility of language and really try to make clear what kind of cultural value are really inherent in languages. So,
thank you. I'm Gracien Atindokbe from University of Boya in Cameroon. I guess you know what Cameroon is.
Yeah.
West Africa. And presently I'm in Germany in the University of Cologne as a visiting lecturer. I have a very short question and then maybe a remark. The question is about, do you think or don't you think that to do LD, one need to be more, just more than a linguist? Because, you know, LD is a fairly new discipline, and we need to train trainers if we want to achieve the goal we are here for. But I think, and I stand to be corrected, that maybe one need to be more than a linguist to do language documentation. Now, after your talk, I felt a bit disturbed because of the distinction you made about the contribution of technology. When you read recent literature, for example, Stephen Bird, yourself, Essential of Language Documentation, you see that technology has a great role to play. But from your talk, I have the feeling that it is secondary. I don't know what I got you well. Because I can't imagine language documentation without good technology. For example, when you think about verbal language, non-verbal communication, I think video recording here is very important. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let me briefly start with a comment, and then answer the question. The issue about technology is, I think it is not secondary, but it is not also in the absolute center of things. So it's imaginable to do language documentation without any technology, and there are many settings where it is not feasible to come in with big aperture, etc., and recorders and video recording, etc. You basically are in the danger of destroying the kind of environment you actually want to document. So I think there's no imperative to make use of all the possibilities of the technology if this is not feasible in a specific context, and you can actually do good documentation by just feed notes and other things. In principle, you don't have to use the technology. The point is to say, wherever it is feasible to use technology. It would be stupid not to use it. Yeah, so if you're working in an island where there's no electricity and not much technology has been actually introduced, I think it would not be feasible to go in there with big technology. But coming back and editing your field notes and working on your field notes, it's stupid not to use the technology you actually have. You can scan your notes and you can use Toolbox in processing, etc., etc. And they're two different issues. So as long as you're controlling things from a scientific point of view, of course you should make use of whatever the best thing is. But that's not the only consideration. Regarding your first question about you have to be more than a linguist, yes. But the real answer is you have to be a team. I mean, and documentary linguistics advocates working in teams and not thinking of the lone rider going somewhere and getting the real thing. You basically have to work with many people and try to get expertise from different ends. You can't really do it all by yourself. I mean, it's very obvious that you cannot learn all the things. You have to work with different people, and I've been working on three different projects with quite different types of special expertise, even within linguistics. I mean, it never used to be the case that the linguist who did field work was equally good in all parts of even the basic analysis. There are people who like phonology and phonetics, and they did great phonology and phonetics, and the relative clause analysis didn't really convince anyone, and the other way around. Yeah, so, I mean, if you really want to do good analysis and documentation, you really want to draw on as many expertise as you can think of.
I'm David Nathan from SOAS, and my question is, I guess, really whether to what extent you still feel that documentary linguistics is a distinct discipline. I was encouraged by your statement that you were agnostic about analytical formats for primary data, but yet it seems the primary data is still the input to descriptive linguistics. I'm wondering how agnostic you are about primary data, because you talked about the cost of interdisciplinarity, but at no point did I see any interdisciplinarity between documentary linguists and descriptive linguists. So the concrete question is really whether the primary data is the input to that sort of descriptive linguistic path you mentioned, or whether you think it can be the primary data that might be wanted by communities for what they want to do, or for what ethnographers want to do, or what pedagogists, educators, and others might want to do.
The level of primary data is supposed to be of use to different user groups. I mean, that has been the basic tenet for the time, which includes descriptive linguists. And in as much as you agree with the point about the analytical minimum, descriptive linguistics has very strong and direct input into the production of primary data, because the basic techniques for segmentation come from descriptive linguistics. So I think descriptive linguistics has a very great role to play in producing this level of primary data with regard to field notes and recordings. There's, to my mind, no great doubt about that. But that doesn't mean that the primary data cannot be used by various other groups, because the main purpose of the primary data or the main purpose of the analysis within the documentation framework is to make the data accessible. And what the type of transcription and translation which has been evolved over 100 years within descriptive linguistics is a fairly useful way of presenting primary data. You can, of course, question that and say there are other ways of representing primary data, and then we can discuss whether there are really differences or really other options. But what I've been arguing for is a fairly conservative view of how you represent raw data in terms of primary data.
We hope to get the discussion going throughout the conference, but now please join me for thanking the speaker. Daniel Kaufman, if you haven't had your credit card back, please go back to the registration.